Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the years, we've done a lot of shows about why it's so hard to find a therapist who takes insurance. According to a ProPublica and NPR investigation, there are not enough therapists in insurance networks to serve those seeking care. Although almost all Americans are now insured, about half of people with mental illnesses are unable to access treatment, and the consequences can be devastating. More than 500 psychologists, psychiatrists, and therapists in nearly all 50 states, from rural communities to big cities, shared their experiences with the investigative team. Many say they leave insurance networks because they interfere with patient care, they get tangled in red tape, and reimbursement rates are notoriously low. Insurance companies have withheld reimbursements or questioned whether patients, even those vulnerable to suicide, needed to continue their treatment. According to the report, therapists have tried to stick it out. They have foregone denied payments. They've taken second jobs. They've sought therapy for their own support. But the hundreds who spoke with ProPublica and NPR said they each faced a moment in which they decided they had to leave the network. If you have struggled to find a therapist who takes insurance, we would love to hear from you. Or if you are a provider who has had these kinds of challenges with insurance companies, or maybe you cannot get by on the low reimbursement rates, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Joining us are two reporters from the team who worked on this investigation. Annie Waldman is an award-winning reporter who covers healthcare for ProPublica. Hi, Annie. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Ritu Chatterjee is an award-winning health correspondent with NPR with a focus on mental health. Hi, Ritu. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. So glad to be here.
Well, thank you both and your team for this important investigation. Stories of people struggling to find therapists are so common, but it's really incredible that you and your team have spoken with so many providers about what it is like from their perspective. Annie, why don't you start off? What sparked this investigation?
Yeah, so last year, my colleagues at ProPublica, they started to look at health insurance very broadly. They mostly focused on physical health care. So insurance companies denying coverage of chronic diseases, or for example, refusing to pay for cancer treatment. But when we did an engagement call out to our readers and we said, what should ProPublica focus on? We actually received dozens of responses saying that we needed to look at mental health care. And so earlier this year, ProPublica assembled a team of reporters, myself and my colleagues, Maya Miller, Dua Eldeeb, and Max Blau, to focus on mental health care. And in the most simple terms, you know, we really wanted to understand, why is it that when you have insurance, it can be so hard to access mental health treatment? You know, few of us haven't heard this one before, right? You have insurance, but you can't find a therapist. None take your insurance, or there are wait lists for months. You know, I've heard it from friends and family members. Perhaps you've experienced it too. And we all know when people can't access care, the consequences can be absolutely devastating, you know, which is why we have heard such an acute level of frustration from so many people that we spoke to, patients and their families. And I think this frustration of not being able to find care, which you are entitled to through your insurance, many people often blame the mental health providers for leaving networks, or they blame it on a shortage of therapists. But what we found was this wasn't the whole story. You know, we really found what most people don't realize is that insurance companies play a really big role in this. So when we first started investigating this issue, we put a call out, another call out to our readers for tips, and we actually received hundreds of responses, and over half of them were from therapists of all types, social workers, counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, and hundreds of these providers told us how unsustainable and challenging it was to work with insurance companies. And what our interviews revealed to us really quickly was that the insurance companies in this country have pretty quietly and with minimal pushback from regulators, they have taken on a really large role in mental health care. So what we heard was that it's really sometimes the insurance companies, not the therapists, that are determining who can get the treatment, what kind of treatment they can get, and for how long. And as you mentioned, you know, they face a lot of red tape when dealing with insurance companies, delayed and low payments, audits, and reviews. So many told us that despite all of this, they try to stay in networks. They are really committed to helping patients. But they told us also that the practices of insurance companies were pushing them out. And suddenly, it was like a light bulb moment. Many providers are opting out of insurance networks because they are being squeezed out. And it was really from these hundreds of interviews that we started to realize, you know, how our readers could really understand these stories more empathetically is directly from the providers themselves, which is why we wanted to partner with NPR so that these stories could really come to life with audio. And that's how Ritu came in.
Well, and it's what's so incredible is these people are so dedicated. You begin the story with three examples. Carter J. Carter became a therapist to help young people struggling with their mental health. Roseanne Marmore wanted to support survivors of trauma. Kendra F. Dunlap aspired to serve people of color. They're so dedicated. Ritu, what was it like hearing stories directly from providers?
Oh, you know, it was very, I've been hearing some of these stories for a few years now in the process of reporting on other stories on my mental health beat. And I think like most people, I hadn't realized until I was a few years into covering mental health that this was a problem that providers faced. I've heard these stories over the years from, you know, therapists who practice solo. I've heard it from psychiatrists and psychologists who practice in big hospitals or big institutions, which, you know, those institutions often have other people dealing directly with insurance companies. But these stories are just so routine it wasn't until I think a couple years ago that I also started to realize, as Annie mentioned, that I think most people tend to blame therapists or providers because that's who they're talking to, that's who they're trying to get in touch with. And their frustration comes out at providers saying, well, why don't they take insurance? And, you know, I've been, so when Annie and her colleagues at ProPublica reached out and I heard about just how many providers that they talked to, I was like, oh yeah, we have to get these stories, these personal stories out. And as you mentioned, Rose, that these providers are really dedicated. You know, I think most people who get into the business of mental health care are looking for a connection, and really, like most healthcare providers, want to help people feel better, get better. And yet this sort of wall of obstacles they face to provide equitable access to care is just not understood. That's the outsized role that insurers play in prohibiting that.
Annie, earlier you mentioned that the nation's insurers have assumed an outsized role in mental health care. Is this new or has this always been the case?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, it kind of has developed over the past few decades. What's really interesting is that everything kind of changed in 2008. That was when the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act passed. It's also known as MAPEA. And before this time, you know, insurance companies could actually place really hard caps on mental health care. You know, they could say, we're only going to allow 6 sessions, and then we're going to do a clinical review of you. Or they could say, you know, we're only going to allow 10 days of inpatient care, and then that's it. But when this law passed, it really required insurance companies to provide the same access to mental health care as physical health care. And so these kinds of harder requirements, like caps on the number of days or sessions, they went away. But what replaced it was this greater focus and greater attention on the utilization of these services. So insurance companies, instead of just kind of having arbitrary caps, are now having the subtle approach where they're turning to providers to really look at how they're meeting out this treatment. And they're really questioning them about, is it appropriate? Is it wasteful? Is this, you know, does somebody actually need therapy? Whereas these questions used to be something that clinicians would really be the main people to answer for. You know, the insurance companies wouldn't have that upper hand. And so, you know, it really has kind of shifted into this more subtle way to limit care in recent years, when before it just was kind of more arbitrary hard caps.
And a number, go ahead, Ritu.
No, I was just going to say, before it was just outright blatantly discriminatory, and now it's become, as Annie says, more subtle. So they're still using that sort of time limit for disorders that are often, and illnesses that are often chronic, and trying to set time limits using different tactics and different languages and more subtler ways. But they're still kind of imposing that time cap that they used to before the Mental Health Parity Act came into being.
Ritu, some of the insurance companies got back to you, others didn't. Are some insurance companies better than others, or did these issues crop up regardless of the company?
So from what I know, having covered these issues for the past few years, it's pretty much across the board. Some insurance companies may be trying to do a little better, but it is pretty widespread. And again, and I think as some of Annie's and her colleagues' reporting has showed, like state by state, things might be changing how insurers operate, but it's an industry-wide practice, I would say. Annie, would you agree?
Yeah. And just to add on to what you were saying, you know, we did for, you know, our story in the process, we kind of went to various insurance companies that came up in our reporting, and we kind of laid out the arguments and the observations of many of these providers and said kind of, what say you? Mm-hmm. And, you know, many kind of came back to us and they said they were super committed to ensuring access to mental health providers. They also emphasized that their plans are in compliance with state and federal laws. They also said that they had practices in place to make sure that people had access to providers and that the reimbursement rates were actually reflecting market value. But, you know, when we hear this from the insurance companies and then hundreds of providers have a very different perspective, I mean, it just kind of raised some flags for us. So, you know, it's kind of, they might say that and it is likely true. It's just that when you hear a different perspective, it does kind of challenge that that status quo.
And I think also, if I can jump, add one last thing, and I think there have been independent analyses by, say, you know, for example, this actuary firm, Milliman, over the years, that have independently just looked at sort of rates providers get and have documented that, yes, they get poorer rates, are paid more poorly. There have been peer-reviewed studies published on this. So, you know, besides the therapist's perspective itself, I think there have been independent analyses of how the insurance industry works, what its payment rates are, you know, level of access people have. And that sort of, I think, you know, again, like paints a very different picture than what insurance companies say they're doing.
Ritu Chatterjee is an award-winning health correspondent with NPR. Annie Waldman is an award-winning reporter who covers healthcare for ProPublica. And today we're talking about the investigation about why it is so hard to find a therapist who takes insurance. You may have heard the piece over the weekend from NPR called Finding a Therapist Who Takes Your Insurance Can Be Nearly Impossible. Here's why. And then the ProPublica piece is on our website also, and it's called Why I Left the Network. If you have any questions or comments, if you have personal stories to share either as a patient or as a provider, we would love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. I think it's important to also talk about the fact that people go to therapy for many different reasons. You know, maybe people are having relationship issues or issues with work. And then people are also having bipolar disorder issues and they really need help. And I think it's so important to focus on that because you write that more than a dozen therapists said insurers urge them to reduce care when their patients were on the brink of harm, including suicide. So, Annie, can you talk about this? I mean, in many cases, we're talking about very serious issues here. It's not like, you know, I'm not trying to minimize this, but having a hard time with work and then going from therapist to therapist is one thing. But when you're dealing with the potential of suicide, that's another thing altogether. And you're putting that, you know, depending on what the insurance company thinks, you might not be able to get that help.
Exactly. And there was one story with a provider that really exemplified this, you know, the impact on patients who are particularly going through crisis moments or chronic mental health illnesses. And that is the story of psychologist Melissa Todd. She is based in Eugene, Oregon. She was treating a young woman with a history of trauma whose father had died unexpectedly. And, you know, in the first few sessions, Todd began to realize that her constellation of symptoms really kind of reflected a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And so she was treating this woman for about 6 months when suddenly her insurance company initiated a series of utilization reviews. And in these reviews, the insurance company began to question whether this young woman's therapy was even necessary. Melissa Todd walked the insurance reviewer through the details of her patient's fragile state. She worried her patient could even attempt suicide if care was cut off at the wrong time. She made this clear to the insurance company, but the insurance company responded that this patient needed to be actively experiencing severe symptoms all the time to continue with treatment, and even suggested that the therapy wasn't working. And, you know, one thing about a disorder like bipolar disorder, many other mental health disorders or conditions, you know, it is a chronic condition. It ebbs and flows. You know, somebody is not constantly in crisis. And so for Melissa Todd to hear that she had to actively be experiencing severe symptoms to continue a treatment, it felt like a misunderstanding of the pathological reason for why she was in therapy to begin with. And so in the end, the insurance company actually even demanded a date when therapy would no longer be needed. This was an astounding moment for Melissa Todd. She couldn't believe that they were trying to put an end date on therapy. And so she left the insurance network so that she could treat her patient without interference. And this is not a story that is alone. You know, we heard similar stories from many different therapists. In fact, we spoke with 44 providers who said that they left networks after insurers questioned the necessity of care. So this can mean, you know, a patient is in crisis going through the grief of a partner that they just lost, and an insurance company might come in and say, when are you ending treatment? You know, so it's not just, you know, people struggling with work or struggling with family. While those are very valid reasons to seek mental health care, these can be crisis moments in which the insurance company is coming in and questioning the validity of your treatment.
Right, exactly. And in this case, it was United Healthcare that began to question Melissa Todd and whether the therapy was even necessary. Now, in this case, when she left the network so she could treat her patients without interference, the patient could afford to pay out of pocket because of a small settlement after her father's sudden death. But that is not always the case, Ritu. So what happens to patients who cannot pay out of pocket?
You know, they often, the big cost of this is people ration care. If you can't afford to, you just opt out. So I'll give you another example of a story that I actually reported last year about a severely suicidal teen who after 2 years of having you know, attempted suicide. Her parents tried to find her good care and eventually did find a residential evidence-based therapy that specialized with teenage girls with high suicidal risks. And she spent, you know, a couple months there and had just started to get better when the insurance company did one of these reviews. And in this case, I was able to get the phone call of two review calls where the insurance reviewer talks to the psychiatrist, treating psychiatrist of the patient. And again, as Annie mentioned in her story, there is this push to give an end date. Well, when is she going to get better? And, you know, just think of like doctors treating diabetes or chronic kidney disease being asked like, okay, when is this treatment going to end? When are you going to send the patient home? And in this case, eventually, after a couple more several weeks of treatment, that after the first call was approved, and then the second call was like, nope, we can't continue this any longer. If you send her home, and if she attempts suicide again, then we can reconsider it. So you're basically, the insurance reviewer is saying, well, let her go home. Let her attempt suicide again, and then we will cover treatment. So this inclination to cover just crisis and not a chronic condition. And in this case, the parents were able to pay for treatment out of pocket for some time. But then eventually they ran out of funds, and they had to take their daughter out. And as expected, within a few weeks of going home, she attempted again.
Mm.
And that is the story. You know, luckily this girl survived, and eventually they found other treatment that, you know, she's doing much, much better. But and as the parents told me, you know, we had the resources to pay out of pocket at least for a little bit and keep trying for other avenues of care. But think about parents or even individuals, adults who are trying to get, who don't have the resources, who don't have the support system, and who just give up. And the reality of, you know, trying to get mental health care when you're in crisis, trying to get connected to care, is it's the worst possible time to actually get connected to care because of all these issues, the time it takes, the connection, the time it takes to establish connection with a provider, see if the treatment works. And so, you know, this costs lives.
Exactly. I mean, Annie, therapists told you all that they have seen their patients sink deeper into depression, suffer worsening panic attacks, and wind up in the ER after insurers refused to cover their treatment.
Yeah. And, you know, what really kind of came from a lot of these interviews, you know, this feeling that kind of permeated so many with providers is the feeling of moral injury that providers take on when they know that a patient might need more care and they want to give that patient care. But being part of that insurance network means that you have to play by the rules of the insurance network. And it puts up this, you know, it causes this kind of choice for therapists. Do I play by the rules of the insurance network that wants me to limit care to somebody that I might believe needs more care, is entitled to more care? Or do I leave the network and therefore maybe put my patient into a situation where they might not be able to afford or sustain therapy in the long run? And it is this choice that weighs upon so many providers, you know, and this is not something that, you know, they can kind of shut their door at the end of the day. So many people get into the mental health field because they are incredibly sensitive and empathetic individuals who really know how to feel for others. And when they have to make this choice of, you know, abiding by the rules of the insurance company or doing what they feel is morally right, it really lingers with them and stays with them. And, you know, I don't want to overdo this, but, you know, we do hear a lot of the pain from providers as they go through the decision of whether to stay in network or not. And it was really from this quite powerful feeling that we heard time and time again across the country in all different states and rural areas, you know, large cities, that we knew that this would be something that resonated with everyone. And it would answer that larger question for patients who are constantly wondering, why can't I get into somebody's therapy chair with the insurance that I have?
We have an email from Wendy who writes, years ago, a friend had a psychotic break and was hospitalized. With no family in the country, I had to find a psychiatrist for her. She supposedly had, quote, good insurance, but I went through pages and made calls and no one had availability. She was out of the hospital for 3 days when she had to go back in. When politicians tell you there's mental health parity, do not believe them. When they say they're supplying more beds for mental health patients, ask them who will be providing the care. Wendy says most therapists will not take Medicare either. And I just want to share a couple of resources for people who are struggling with this, because I've been through this for years, trying to find a loved one who had very deep depression. And exactly what you're saying on the show today about how long it takes, how frustrating it is, it could be a full-time job. I have found two resources that are very, very good. Psychology Today, you can search for a therapist, psychologist, or a psychiatrist. The search tool is so good. You can put in the kind of insurance you have, including Medicare. And then I recently found Total Life. They take Medicare. It's specifically for people who are on Medicare. I have a loved one who sees a therapist twice a week. It's all covered. It's absolutely amazing. It's totallife.com. They'll do it on Zoom or on a phone if you don't use a computer. So I wanted to throw that out there because I know a lot of people are suffering with this. Annie, do you want to share any other resources?
No, those are great resources. Another resource for us in our reporting that could also be a great resource for people who are looking for therapists are psychological associations. Every single state has a psychological association, and they often have directories of providers who are accepting patients, and sometimes they have their biography and a little information about them. And these are folks who are really kind of engaged in the broader community, and so they oftentimes are more responsive when you reach out to them. And same goes for social worker associations, marriage and family therapist associations, or associations for every single kind of licensed degree. But I wanted to say one thing about Wendy's email, which was, it's a heartbreaking story that she shared. But one thing she said was, not trusting the Mental Health Parity Act, that, the federal government isn't doing very much. That, we actually are looking into that right now, because the Department of Labor is supposed to be holding insurance companies accountable. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're supposed to kind of be reviewing insurance companies to make sure that they're not overly putting restrictions on mental health care that they're not putting on medical care. So that can be prior authorization requirements or utilization reviews, or what Ritu was describing as forcing patients to undergo fail-first policies or step therapy protocols, like when a company refuses to pay for higher cost or higher intensity services until it can be shown that somebody has failed at a lower level. And I just want to say it's really important for people to understand their rights and the laws, so that when an insurance company does something that they feel like violates their ability to access mental health care, that they know the right avenues to file complaints or investigate them on their own.
Just to follow up on that, Annie, what will it take to ensure the federal government does its job on this and to ensure that these insurance companies cannot just go in and tell insurers, therapists, this just doesn't seem like we want to continue with this patient. You're going to have to cut them off. What will it take?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take a lot, right? I think, we're in early days now where people are finally kind of coming together to share information and share their stories. But, what a lot of people in this, advocates in this area have been fighting against is the stigma of mental health. It is incredibly stigmatized to have a mental health condition or disorder in this country. And a lot of people don't want to share their experience because they're afraid of what people will think of them. They're afraid of how their jobs might judge them. They're afraid of what family members might do. And that's completely legitimate. But unless we start to have more open conversations about mental health, the importance of accessing care for mental health, the importance of destigmatizing mental health and accepting people for all the different shades and surprises that they, you know, of our conditions or disorders in our minds, you know, it's going to be very difficult. You know, insurance companies have the upper hand. They're able to take advantage of the silence that really people live in when they have a condition.
Ritu, what would you add?
I do think, you know, we are at a time when there is bipartisan support in Congress in addressing the crisis. And I think lawmakers are aware of issues with sort of the lack of enforcement of Mental Health Parity Act. But as Annie mentioned, it's going to take a lot to kind of change things. But I will say that, yes, definitely the stigma part is a big thing. But in terms of actually lawmakers doing more, I do think I'm hopeful. It will take time, but I'm hopeful because, you know, one thing that the pandemic has done, it has chipped away at the stigma around mental illness. I think people are becoming more open to talking about it. And I think there is a widespread in, you know, data comes up in poll after poll over the past few years that people recognize that mental health is just as important as physical health. And there is kind of a more open, honest conversation about the need to address this. So, you know, And the crisis is never, you know, it's was already brewing before the pandemic, but it's reached a new level since. And so given the need and kind of the acknowledgement both by the public and lawmakers that this is something that needs to be addressed, I'm hopeful, but I still think it's going to take a while.
Ritu, do you have any other resources to share with our listeners?
I will say, though, especially for people struggling, perhaps not kind of in the throes of crisis, I think the resources you and Annie mentioned are great for those moments. But otherwise, you know, families and loved ones of people who are struggling and those who are battling like a chronic mental illness, I would say the National Alliance for Mental Illness is a great resource. And through them, or even you can look on Facebook, there are often local groups of, you know, for example, I'll say having covered children's mental health a lot, there are often where parents end up finding support are in local, and sometimes the groups can be virtual groups spread across the country of other parents dealing with the same things. And NAMI is a great place to start looking for those resources. But they are out there, and because, and often started by parents who've dealt with this by themselves and then eventually want to be able to help others in the same situation. So look for those support groups, whether it be through NAMI or, you know, any other local advocacy groups. I think they can be an incredible, incredible resource to just have a, if you're the loved one of somebody struggling with a mental illness, you know, just knowing, because I think most people know and want to help a loved one, but don't know how. Mm-hmm. So connecting with these local or, you know, spread across the nation, virtual groups can be incredibly helpful, both to find providers, how to navigate insurance. You know, you can find people who've dealt with sort of filing appeals, but try and connect with others. Do not try and do this in isolation, because it's incredibly hard. As you mentioned, it can be a full and it can be and often is a full-time job.
Yes, so true. Today, we're talking about a ProPublica NPR investigation about why it is so hard to find a therapist who takes insurance. Ritu Chatterjee is an award-winning health correspondent with NPR. Annie Waldman is an award-winning reporter covering healthcare with ProPublica. Let's hear from a few callers. And thank you so much again, Wendy, for the email. And I'm so sorry to hear about your friend. I hope your friend has gotten the care that they need. Let's go to Don in Berkeley. Hi, Don. Thank you for holding.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. We're Kaiser members, my wife and I, and we asked for over the phone help, and they at Kaiser for the reason, by the way, it was for an illness that we had to adjust to and figure out the stages to progress through. They immediately assigned us a contracted over the phone psychologist, and there was fortunately we were able to find out what the company was before we engaged, and they didn't abide to the HIPAA laws for privacy. And when you read the contract online of that company, they were going to share all our information with, quote unquote, their third party members, who they didn't say who those people were. So in essence, when we engaged with one of the agents, they basically gaslighted us and said, we don't know what you're talking about, when we refer to the HIPAA laws. Hmm. And furthermore, to address the overworked person, we asked them, well, what do you do there? We said, well, I work for three different companies.
Oh, wow.
So not only were we going to give it to the contracted company, that person was also going out, spreading out to other companies themselves. Mm-hmm. So we did push back. We pushed back hard. And Kaiser eventually did give us an in-house person to counsel with. And we did come out satisfied with that. But we had to really push back. And if you're not aware of your personal information possibly being advertised, exploited, marketed, people can be vulnerable if you don't read the fine lines.
Right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Don, and I'm so glad that you ended up getting the help that you needed. But concerns about these HIPAA laws. Annie, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what a lot of people don't realize when they use their insurance to access mental health care, in particular, you know, therapy sessions, insurance companies do have a right to request pretty personal information from your therapist in order to validate claims and validate the treatment. So, for example, progress notes, therapy progress notes, insurance companies can ask for that. And, you know, while, of course, I'm sure they maintain that the systems are private and up to standards, you know, a lot of people may not want to be in a situation where their kind of private information is accessible in that way. And so these are completely valid concerns. And it's always really important to have that conversation with your therapist and, you know, your insurance company provider before you start accessing care, just to understand what are those limitations that might be out there.
Well, thank you again for sharing that story, Dawn. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to
the
show.
Hello.
Did we lose? Hi, Greg.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences to what you people have been talking about. First of all, the waiting list to see people are just endless. It's not just in mental health, it's in physical health, too. Often, as your people have indicated, your guests have indicated, even Medicare doesn't get taken by a lot of these people in the mental health field. And so it's incredibly difficult, and there are waiting lists as long as your arm for both mental health and physical health. I've found that to be the case. You know, I just think that it's just emblematic of just the inadequate healthcare system that we've got in general. That people end up in these situations because I wanted to get treatment from a specialist to deal with PTSD, and that was really a nightmare. So it is a difficult system to not only navigate but get care from.
Mm. Well, thank you for the call, Greg, and sharing your experience. We're going to take one more caller, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Yes, thank you. I think what we need to do is look at the root of the problem, and that is culturally that this country is moving towards a strong monetization. Sorry, I have something in my mouth of healthcare, and that's become the race. So we have a competition between our healthcare of who can save the most money and who can turn down the greatest number of people who might cost us extra money. So until we stop monetizing it and make it a, quote, right, it's not going to change. And all different levels. Just look at other levels. You'll see the same problem.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. We're getting a lot of emails along similar lines that people are having a very hard time finding a therapist. And this is nothing new, but I feel like it's getting more attention than ever. Annie, what do you think it's going to take to change the system?
That's a great question. I mean, it's going to be, I think, a ground up change that's going to actually make it easier for people to access mental health care. I think people, you know, like your listeners, should be calling, you know, talking to their family members about this, talking to their congresspeople about this, talking to advocates about this, because I think that once, you know, it's prioritized, people understand it as a priority of the citizens, then it will just hopefully kind of bubble up to the top and change can happen.
Ritu, what would you like to add?
No, I think Annie's point is great. I would add, though, one other resource that people should keep in mind, especially if one is in crisis or approaching crisis, or whether it's a loved one, is 988, the new three-digit mental health crisis line. And that's, I will say, that is already starting to slowly shift kind of the stigma around help seeking. Now, you know, the level of care and counseling you can get on the phone with 988 can vary depending on what part of the country you are in. But I do think that's another positive thing that's happened in the past couple of years that's both starting to change the conversation around mental health, raising awareness, and giving people in crisis a way to get immediate care and also potentially find ways to connect to care, because whoever you're talking on the phone, for those who need additional follow-up care, the counselor at the other end is supposed to help you find, you know, a list of providers might take your insurance in your area. And so just to keep that in mind, but I agree with Annie on every point she made that it is going to take a sort of ground up kind of movement to start changing things and people really talking more openly about this and demanding change.
You know, one thing we didn't get to talk about is the session time. I mean, my loved one is seeing someone twice a week. And you report that insurance companies often pressure therapists to keep their sessions to 45 minutes. Nanette Larson, a therapist in Walnut Creek, told you she had a patient who was a stroke survivor and couldn't speak very fast, so sessions took an hour. How often is it, Annie, that these companies are trying to shorten the sessions?
It's actually incredibly often, you know, and it's not one company either. We actually heard stories from providers where they are getting letters in the mail that say, you are an outlier therapist. You see more patients for 60-minute sessions than any of your peers. This is a letter to educate you, and we hope that you do 45-minute sessions. So, you know, providers do feel pressured to see people in shorter windows of time, which might not be helpful for them. As you mentioned, the story of the stroke survivor, but, you know, sometimes doing certain types of therapy, for example, certain types of trauma therapy like EMDR, it requires more time to kind of unpack that trauma, analyze it, talk about it, and then put it back in the box at the end of the session. And so, you know, ultimately, if we take a step back, who should we be trusting with our mental health? The provider who is in the office with us, talking to us once a week or twice a week about what we're going through, or an insurance company who is not in the room with us? And that's a question that we as a society should be asking right now as we talk about mental health protections and what to do next.
Well, let's take another caller. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, for taking my call. Honestly, I think, you know, national health care is what's needed, all for everything, for dental care as well as for mental care. I mean, we cannot trust insurance companies whose main objective is to gain profit to be able to take care of us, honestly. This is something that's not, it's something that we all deserve. We pay into this Medicare all our lives during when we work. Everybody should have it. And, you know, Medicare for All is something that is the most basic right that a human being can have. I mean, we have money to send $20 billion to Israel to bomb children and to destroy healthcare workers abroad, but we don't have money to take care of our of us. It is absolutely, it's disgusting, obviously, honestly. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Lisa. We need to take just a quick break. Annie and Ritu, if you can stay with us for about 10 more minutes, we would greatly appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break. Annie Waldman is an award-winning reporter with ProPublica. Ritu Chatterjee is an award-winning correspondent with NPR. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are finding out why it is so hard to find a therapist who takes insurance. I hope you can take the time to read and listen to an incredible investigation from ProPublica and NPR. They spoke with more than 500 psychologists, psychiatrists, and therapists in nearly all states. They said that insurance companies are interfering with patient care. The therapists get tangled in red tape. They have to talk to outsourced customer service reps for they stay online for so long. We all know what that's like. And then the reimbursement rates are notoriously low. We're speaking with Annie Waldman, an award-winning reporter with ProPublica, and Ritu Chatterjee, an award-winning correspondent with NPR. So we talked about the pressure to shorten the visits. What about the reimbursement rates? Because therapists are doing very intense work. And you write that more than 130 providers chose to leave networks because of low reimbursement rates. Therapists earn about $98 for a 45-minute session from commercial insurers, whereas their out-of-network colleagues can earn more than double that amount. So Ritu, what stood out for you on this issue? So many of the people you spoke to said they have a hard time making ends meet.
Yeah, again, this is, you know, when I first heard about this a few years ago from providers, I was just shocked, and I forget who it was, and I've heard this from a couple of people, and there was a study that came out last year, a peer-reviewed study as well, that, you know, psychiatrists get paid less than physicians, and I think we've in our reporting site did also a comparison between physician assistants and psychiatrists. So they get paid less to prescribe the same psychiatric medication than, say, somebody in a physical health office, like a doctor or a physician's assistant. And when I first heard that, I was shocked. But again, it's just... Yes, having been on the beat for a while, it's just sort of something that I've come to understand is a huge and long known issue that needs to be addressed. Mm. And this is where I think that lawmakers can make a difference.
You know, Ritu, I was just thinking, I listen to NPR constantly, and I would love it if when a politician is interviewed on NPR, it'd be great on Morning Edition if you can jump in there and say, I've got a question about therapy, psychologists, mental health, and insurance, and point blank ask them or, you know, one of their supporters about why this is happening. Have you had many conversations with politicians, high-level politicians, about these issues?
I have not, but I guess what I have followed, you know, just over the past few years, a lot of congressional hearings. And this is something they're aware of. And I mean, given that we, all the other talk about what a politically divided time we live in, like covering mental health is slight, I have a slightly different perspective where there seems to be bipartisan support in addressing, you know, politicians might differ on kind of the solutions, but addressing issues like not maybe specifically payment, but like access to mental health care and addressing the mental health crisis. So I know that they're aware of it, and I know there's an effort to at least fix this in not for commercial insurance yet at the national level, but I think Medicare, if I'm remembering this correctly. And I think more of us should be asking our leaders these questions, including us journalists.
Yes, definitely. Because if it is in fact bipartisan, you have to wonder, well, what is happening then, given that so much is not these days? It's so hard to get so much done these days.
Yeah.
But just to also cut in, you know, one thing that I think is very familiar with all of us is that no American family, you know, no family in this country is untouched by issues of mental health, you know, and even individuals in Congress or in the Senate, they too have their own stories. Perhaps they're not open about them, but they do, you know, and I think always back to Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, who has been very open about the fact that his own brother struggled with schizophrenia for decades and lost his battle with the illness nearly 20 years ago. Mm. And for this reason, you know, mental health has been a very important advocacy point for him. And he has fought for it in Washington, D.C. And I use this example to kind of elevate that, you know, so many American families struggle with this, and oftentimes they don't talk about it openly. But if we can start to share our stories and share our humanity with each other, I do think that politicians will be more likely to share their stories as well. And regardless of what party one belongs to, everybody knows that getting mental health treatment for people who need it, the most vulnerable in our society, is something that people can agree on.
Hmm. Annie Waldman is an award-winning reporter who covers healthcare for ProPublica. Ritu Chatterjee is an award-winning health correspondent with NPR with a focus on mental health. We've been talking about their investigation about why it is so hard to find a therapist who takes insurance. Ritu and Annie, thanks to you and your team for this important investigation. We'd love to continue the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your calls and your emails. We will definitely continue to do shows about this. In the coming months, if you have any ideas or guest ideas, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.